Hello, and welcome to this podcast, just one of a series on the early 19th century German writer Heinrich von Kleist. My name is Sean Allen, and I'm from the University of Warwick. And in today's podcast, I'll be talking about Kleist's novella, The Earthquake in Chile, with Ricardo Schmidt and Stephen Howe, both from the University of Exeter. One of the best known of Kleist's stories, The Earthquake in Chile, was first published in 1807 in a journal. It was republished in 1810 in the first volume of Heinrich von Kleist's Tales, or Erzählungen, as the volume was called. And I'm going to turn first to Stephen Howe, and perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the key points of the story.
So the story centres on the relationship between two lovers, Josefa Astorham, the only daughter of the nobleman Don Henrico Astorham, and her bourgeois tutor Jeronimo Ruggiero. Upon learning of their affair, Don Henrico has Jeronimo dismissed from his post and then banishes Josefa to a convent. 9 months later, however, Josefa collapses on the steps of the cathedral during the Corpus Christi procession and gives birth to a child, Philip. Inevitably, the affair causes great scandal. Jeronimo is cast into prison, whilst Josefa is tried and sentenced to death. And so when the earthquake strikes, it allows the two of them to escape, and they later find one another in an idyllic valley scene where the survivors of the disaster come together in a spirit of universal reconciliation. And the following morning, they then decide to return to the city to attend a Thanksgiving sermon at the only cathedral that hasn't been destroyed by the earthquake. And the decision backfires spectacularly when the canon who's presiding over the sermon delivers a hellfire sermon, interpreting the earthquake as an act of divine retribution for what he sees as the sins of Jeronimo and Josefa. And upon delivering his sermon, the attending crowd is effectively transformed into a baying, bloodthirsty mob, and the whole scene descends into a kind of gruesome bloodbath. And so really the central question raised by the text, or rather one of the central questions raised by the text, is, you know, how and why this should come to pass.
So this story, of course, it was based on a real historical event, the Santiago earthquake of 1647. But of course, when people read this story, I'm sure they're also thinking about another earthquake, namely the Lisbon earthquake of 1755, which of course was an event that occurred much closer to Kleist's own lifetime, just 52 years ago. And Ricardo Schmidt, maybe you could say something about why Kleist chose to use the earthquake of Santiago rather than the much more recent earthquake of Lisbon in 1755.
I think setting the earthquake a good 150 years before the time of writing enabled Kleist to portray a society with quite different values. And the values in that society with regard to sexual mores are very harsh, where having sex outside marriage is punishable by death for the woman. And Kleist creates a lot of sympathy for the lovers, because when this death penalty is commuted from death at the stake to death by beheading, the populace is described as greatly outraged by this leniency. And furthermore, execution is a public affair, and the narrator says the pious daughters of the city invited their female friends to witness with them in sisterly companionship this spectacle about to be delivered to divine vengeance. So very economically, the narrator here manages to pour sarcasm on the sadistic pleasure the virgins and matrons in the city get, and thus awakens sympathy with the lovers, and thus also makes the reader follow this line that when the lovers are saved from this rather cruel punishment, that we sort of think, God is on our side.
Of course, the plight of the lovers in the story raises a whole range of issues. One of the questions is, of course, Are they actually rescued as a result of divine intervention? Or are they perhaps, as some characters in the story seem to believe, actually the very cause of the earthquake itself? And this, I think, opens up the very problem of interpretation in this story. In fact, one critic has said that the whole point of this story is actually the question of interpretation. But I think we can sharpen that up a little bit by looking at some of the 18th century discourses that this story engages with, and in particular the problem of theodicy. Perhaps, Steve, you could explain a little bit about what that concept actually meant.
The question of theodicy is concerned with this question of the place of evil in the world and how one reconciles the existence of evil in the world with the idea of God's beneficence. And in the aftermath of the Lisbon earthquake, this became a particularly salient issue in intellectual debate amongst theologians and philosophers, who began to wrestle anew with this question of divine providence and the destructive power of nature. And as I say, the heart of this lay that age-old dilemma of how to reconcile God's omnipotence and beneficence given the existence of physical evil. And the traditional view associated with Leibniz was this idea of the best of all possible worlds.
What does that actually mean, the best of all possible worlds?
Essentially the view that, you know, whatever happens on Earth, however much violence might be present, this nonetheless remains the best of all possible worlds. That the violence that and the suffering that we experience is the inevitable consequence of nature's laws, either because it contributes to the greater good or because it's God is a kind of disinterested bystander, one who sets up the world and then leaves it to its devices without taking too much interest in the daily operations and the fate of passing individuals.
So it's a kind of question of perspective. One person's evil is another person's good.
I think so, yes.
But of course this notion that however much misfortune we experience, we're nonetheless living in the best of all possible worlds, was certainly a doctrine that not everybody agreed with at the time. And I think in particular, two voices are particularly prominent in the debate here. One, of course, Voltaire, and the other, Rousseau. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about Voltaire's counter-arguments to Leibniz's doctrine of the best of all possible worlds.
So, I mean, almost immediately following upon the earthquake, Voltaire published his now famous poem on the Lisbon disaster, in which he launched a really quite scathing attack on the traditional optimistic doctrine, this idea of living in the best of all possible worlds. Essentially, Voltaire challenges the defenders of this optimistic viewpoint to confront the realities of what's happened, the realities of physical evil, and not to kind of take refuge behind abstract and sophistical platitudes of this being the best of all possible world, but rather to actually face up to the realities of physical evil and the realities of this suffering on such a scale. In terms of the death toll for the Lisbon earthquake, you know, there's a range of estimates from between 10,000 and 100,000, although most put it, I think, nowadays at around 60,000. So, you know, this was almost on an unprecedented scale, the level of destruction. And so Voltaire essentially rejects out of hand the kind of necessary law argument, this view that, you know, the evil, the suffering in the world somehow contributes to the greater good. And he essentially, implicitly but essentially, rejects God's benevolence by stressing his omnipotence and essentially laying the blame for suffering at God's feet.
Of course, these ideas were ideas that Voltaire also fleshed out in perhaps more detail even in his famous novel Candide. And while we're on the subject of Candide, that novel, of course, contains a character called Jean-Jacques, who I think by everybody's admission is a clear reference to the other philosopher of the Enlightenment at this period, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who also played a very important part, I think, in these debates. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about Rousseau's perspective on the Lisbon earthquake.
Yes, I mean, Rousseau responded directly to Voltaire in what it's now known as his letter to Voltaire on Providence. It was actually a private letter which Voltaire subsequently published, in which, you know, Rousseau responds to these charges against optimism. And in the first instance, Rousseau accuses Voltaire of aggravating human misery with this, you know, deep scepticism concerning God's benevolence. Rousseau suggests that, you know, he will never lose faith in God's benevolence. But he sees this as a question of faith, not a question of reasoning. It's purely a question of personal faith. And in fact, in terms of, I mean, often the two are played off against one another, Voltaire and Rousseau, and Rousseau is seen to be this kind of quite straightforward defence of optimism, which is exactly how Voltaire portrays him in Candide. The reality is slightly more complex. essentially what Rousseau does is that he denies that man can have absolute knowledge of the workings of the universe anyway. And so any attempt to try and interpret natural evil, physical evil, natural suffering, he denies that any of that can be traced back to God's intention. Rousseau's view of God is very much of this kind of absent God, the God who sets up the world as being good and then takes a step back and isn't overly concerned with, you know, the daily workings.
So a natural disaster is simply a natural disaster, an arbitrary event of nature that's neither willed nor wanted by God.
Absolutely. In Rousseau's terms, yes. And in fact, he then goes almost a step further in that he then actually focuses his attention on the kind of human element involved in the disaster. So, for example, he points in terms which actually come across now, I think, as quite callous. He points to things like the fact that they have these cities built up close together, multi-story buildings. He sees this as the root cause of most of the suffering rather than the initial natural element.
So human civilization once again.
Absolutely.
Well, you've told us a little bit about the theories that were prevalent at the time, particularly these ideas of theodicy and Rousseau and Voltaire's critique of those theories. Perhaps you could tell us now a little bit more about how those ideas are actually exemplified in the story itself.
Well, I think there's two ways in which Kleist quotes these particular discourses, and both follow, to my mind, fairly close along Rousseau's lines, but certainly far more so than Voltaire. I think the first aspect relates to this issue that was touched upon earlier of interpretation and the efforts of those affected by the earthquake to draw these kind of causal connections to a divine purpose and to read into the earthquake some kind of divine scheme of justice. And, you know, the theme manifests itself through Kleist's kind of orchestration of individual and collective response to the earthquake, and in particular through the responses of Hieronymo and Josefa on the one hand and the canon on the other hand, and the fact that Hieronymo and Josefa see the earthquake as an instance of divine intervention, you know, as a means of saving them, whereas the canon, by way of contrast, see it as a sign of divine retribution and a kind of judgment on the moral laxity of the city.
Well, of course, the process of interpretation, as you've said, plays a very important role in this story, and that's one of the most important figures in arriving at an interpretation of the story is the figure of the narrator. And Ricardo, perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about the narrator's role in guiding us through this story.
The narrator is, of course, quite satirical about the society of Santiago and pointing to their dubious morality. And the narrator is also siding with the lovers because he seems to be condoning their perspective when he's talking about the unfortunate lovers saved by a miracle of heaven, or when Josefa saves her child and the narrator refers to the precious child which heaven had restored to her. So it seems as if the narrator encourages the reader to believe the lover's own interpretation of events. And by and by, some very discreet things are put in that question that kind of interpretation. There's the event of the abbess's death, and she had been portrayed as a very good person who finds a very bad ending. And we also know that the Church of the Dominicans is left standing. So the Catholic Church hasn't been wholly destroyed, although it had been implicated in this hypocritical morality so far. So there is this tension between what the narrator says and what events are being reported. And there's one particular incident where the lovers are reported at feeling very moved when they reflected on how much misery had to come to the world in order that they may be saved. And that's, I think, sort of a tipping point where the narrator begins to show that the lovers, maybe in their rejoicing at their being saved, are becoming quite selfish.
Some people have talked about Kleist's narrator as being fundamentally unreliable. Do you think this is an unreliable narrator, or do you see that there is a kind of consistency throughout the narrator's perspective on the story?
not entirely unreliable, because there is a sympathy with the lovers. We as readers are encouraged to be sympathetic and yet not to condone their perspective. And that is, I think, what makes the emotional force for the reader, that, you know, you are really encouraged to identify, to experience, see the world from their perspective. And then you are led to a point where you have to realise you can't accept that perspective.
I'd like to turn now to the end of the story, and in particular to that explosion of violence. I don't think anybody reading the story can ever forget how the story ends. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how that violent ending relates to these theories of theodicy that you've been talking about, Steve.
Yes, I mean, as Ricardo has just been saying, the events of the tale show how the earthquake knows no ethical bounds. And, you know, it strikes both good and evil, just and unjust. The violence is the work of kind of blind contingency. You know, all claims to any kind of teleological morality break down when trying to interpret the earthquake, or to impute to nature any kind of divine scheme of justice. And as you say, in the final scenes in the cathedral, this you know, sudden eruption of violence, I think Kleist drives that point to a both logical and aesthetic extreme. When Josefa's resolve to thank God for her rescue eventually leads to her being lynched, and these lynchings are also set in motion, of course, by the crucial impetus of the canon's demonisation of the lovers and his invocation of divine retribution as opposed to divine intervention. And so, with, you know, those brutal murders that follow, which climax in the young child, Juan, having his brain smashed out against a pillar, the error of this mode of thought is made to play out its fullest potentialities. And I think, you know, at the same time, this also leads, again, following Rousseau, to a kind of refocusing of attention away from what you might call physical evil or the suffering wrought by nature, and towards an exploration of the suffering that comes about through human modes of agency.
So stop thinking about the grand metaphysical question of evil and look more closely at the social conditions under which people are living.
I think so, yes.
One of the things that's very striking about this story, I think, is it has a very clear tripartite structure. And I think that has a particular significance. Ricardo, perhaps you could just talk us through this.
The novella begins in the city with social violence, and then a natural disaster interrupts that social violence, and we have a country idyll in between, an Eden kind of paradise where there's social harmony and peace. It ends then again with a return to the city and a renewed outbreak of violence. This time it's not the kind of institutionalised violence, but it's a lynching. Now, tripartite thinking was, of course, very common in that period, but it was usually the tripartite thinking on the model of paradise, paradise lost, paradise regained. Now that we've got the paradise here in the middle, that means the rhythm of the story goes from a redemption story to, wow, we are left with the ending full of violence. And the question is that all pessimism, or is there nihilism, or is there some humanism resolved, or some humanism to be regained from this kind of rhythm?
There is, of course, another way of looking at the tripartite structure of this story. And I think many people of Kleist's time would have read this story and perhaps seen in it an allegory of the French Revolution. And of course, Kleist's views are, and the French Revolution are, notoriously difficult to pin down, and this is perhaps one of the few texts where we really do get some kind of in-depth insight into what he might have thought about the process of revolution. But before we do that, perhaps you could explain, Steve, why it is that readers of this novella would have seen a parallel to the French Revolution.
Yeah, like you say, I mean, Kleist rarely comments directly on the revolution, but if you read his texts, I think they're full of references, some more direct than others, some fairly oblique references to revolutionary discourse, revolutionary experience. I think in this case, as you say, there is a clear reference with regard to this three-part structure as a kind of reflection on the historical course of the revolution. from this the initial vision of a kind of ancien régime social model, a lot of institutionalised violence, followed by this middle section in the valley, and this kind of idyllic interlude, which has frequently been seen as a kind of reflection of the revolutionary ideals of liberty, equality, fraternity. And then, you know, the final scenes with this depiction of kind of mob violence in the cathedral as a reflection of the historical failure of the revolution.
Of course, some people would say that this story ends on an incredibly bleak note as Don Fernando looks at the child he's adopted whose parents have been lynched by the mob. Are we right in reading this story as an extremely pessimistic commentary on the prospects of revolution?
I think we can look at it in two ways. I think on the one hand, it certainly provides a negative view of the revolution as it has occurred at the time that Kleist writing this around 1807, 1806, 1807. I think the point that comes out of the story, to my mind, is this view that the kind of revolutionary violence that's symbolised by the earthquake can't bring about a genuine change in social values, social mores. The idea that, you know, yes, the earthquake brings about the collapse of the physical institutions and the manifestations of the old regime, but you know, the ingrained social moral values remain intact. I think that comes through in the final scenes in the cathedral, where the canon is really able to tap the kind of cultural conditioning of the crowd that's attending in such a way as to essentially restore the pre-existing order. And so I think in those terms, I think it's certainly a reflection on what's happened historically during the revolution. And I think there's also, as you say, a kind of pessimistic view of the potential of revolutionary violence as a kind of sudden overthrow of the existing order. And that, you know, essentially the view that comes out of the text is that the force of cultural conditioning is such that a sudden upheaval, a sudden outbreak of revolutionary violence isn't going to provide that lasting change.
So in short, social structures can't change overnight.
Absolutely.
I'd agree with that, but nevertheless, I think the ending isn't entirely bleak, because it doesn't end with the lynching. It ends with Don Fernando adopting this child and his wife agreeing to it. And the enigmatic sentence on which it ends is when Don Fernando compared Philip with Juan and how he had acquired them, it almost appeared to him as if he had to rejoice. What he had to rejoice about is, of course, the big question, but there is something to rejoice, and we've got to think about that.
Well, The Earthquake in Chile is by no means the only novella by Kleist where critics are, shall we say, somewhat undecided as to how the ending should be interpreted. Thank you very much, Ricardo Schmidt and Stephen Howe.